Hi, I'm Bruce Linton. My LinkedIn says that I'm self-unemployed. And what that means is that I'm probably unemployable, but actively involved with a handful of interesting companies that I hope we can cover in the upcoming discussion on professionally psychedelics.
Where do they go? The smoke rings I blow each night. Oh.
I am delighted to welcome back a friend of the pod, an all-round legend in both psychedelics and cannabis, to speak with Oscar and me today. Bruce Linton, a man whose body of work and CV speaks for itself, but we'll give it a few mentions anyway. After founding and serving as chairman and CEO of Canopy Growth Corporation, overseeing it to become the most well-capitalized cannabis company in the world, Bruce has held leadership positions in companies like Rockify, Oscar Capital, Red Light Holland, Gage Cannabis, and Mind Medicine, just to name a few. Now, serving as founder, chairman, and CEO of Collective Growth Corporation, Bruce is here today to talk everything psychedelics with us. It is a great pleasure to say once more, Bruce, welcome to the Professionally Psychedelics podcast.
I do like that, Professionally Psychedelics. It's taking in a direction I'm pretty supportive of.
Very good. And to elucidate on that support, what led you to psychedelic medicines?
It's possibly the most boring reason anyone will ever state. And it's exactly the same boring reason that I started Tweed and then Canopy. And it's the boring reason that I'm interested in Rockify and creating that. And the boring reason is public policy. And it's my view that unless you're super genius and can invent something that does not exist by sitting by yourself in a room, the second best way to start a business is to try to see a macro public policy change that's going to happen and catch the wave that propels those first movers really rapidly forward and then try to be a best mover. So public policy sounds boring to people because we don't talk about it in the right ways. What it is to me is the governing hand above us that we almost never think about. And after a while, we think protects us when in fact it may or may not. And so in the case of cannabis, it was really obvious to me that we had a prime minister in Canada who had gray hair and he represented the conservative right-hand sort of spectrum of the world. And at the time of his running the country in about 2012, the police chiefs of Canada had come to the conclusion that the current laws on cannabis were unenforceable and they were telling their membership, don't even try. And so if you're a public policy interested person, what you would hear is, person who has an electorate base that's reasonably old has police that aren't happy with rules. And if you have a brain, you'd say, well, that means he's going to change the rules so that the police are happy because his electorate is happy when the police are happy. And on that basis, I dug in and spent a whole day figuring out what might be the public policy framework for making police happy. And it was really clear they were going to create a managed system licensed in order to produce cannabis. And my thought was that there are a lot of people who like cannabis. If you could grow it legally, you probably have a strong customer base. There's no bigger macro trade than governing something that's tens and hundreds of billions of dollars of existing commerce that's just not captured by government. So that was what got me into cannabis. In the case of psychedelics, as soon as I was fired at Canopy, I'd already begun inside of Canopy. I made an acquisition that had a division which was working on psychedelics. The Beckley Foundation had been working on it, and we basically had a way to buy them up, and they ultimately did buy the cannabis part, but pushed out after I was gone the psychedelics part. And the reason I liked the psychedelics part is I just thought these were really even more powerful options for treating illness that were governed by prohibitionist, stereotypical, long-term bias. And we all recoil when we hear about stereotypes and prohibition, but if you pause for a second and say, what do those things sometimes do? Like taking your grandparents' bias and applying it to your current view of the world, that is both stupid and creates opportunity for people who are less stupid because it becomes this massive barrier behind which there's humongous untapped potential and intellectual property. And so my thought on psychedelics was that we're actually having reasonable and thoughtful conversations in this generation about mental health. That doctors have spent the last 100 years getting pretty good at fixing the mechanical parts of our body, right? Oh, you need a new heart, clunk, we'll put one in. Oh, your liver's not working here, clunk, we'll put one in. Some lungs, no problem, we'll hook those up. But when it comes to the electrical part of your body, it's still like going to a garage with your car where they guess, right? You take your car into the garage and you you need a new transmission or you need a new cylinder, no problem. You got a problem with your electrical car problem, you should light your car on fire because there's zero chance you're actually going to get it right in a reasonable time frame of fixing it. Well, it's a bit like your body. And so my view was that we actually had concluded that amputation was no longer an option when it came to things happening in your head. And we were probably going to start to look for better answers. And so that public policy prohibition, the change in mental health perception, got then driven even harder by the fact that Big Pharma, like when I started Canopy, it was almost, we almost got cash from the biggest producer of, we'll call it, well, just use the name, the maker of OxyContin. I sought, got a chance to meet with the family. And my thought was, if you make Oxy and you make all these other painkiller things, you should invest like crazy in cannabis, because if cannabis does what it should, your business is going to fall down and you have a hedge. Thank God they thought they didn't like cannabis because we were so untouchable relative to their business, so they wouldn't talk to me very long. But that whole opportunity of transition got accelerated because people's distrust of Big Pharma and questioning accelerated. And so I would say there's been a confluence of items that have driven companies like MindMed to a rapid, significant capitalization and cash position. And now the question is, how will the two or three of the substantial companies that are listed in this sector use the cash in the next 3 to 5 years to create really helpful solutions for a diversity of topics that don't really right now get treated? Like, I have two boys. One of them has the ability to focus. The other one has some of my skills, which is not focus. And so your choices for him are to take something like a 35-year-old medicine and say, try that on with all kinds of side effects, or nothing. And so I just think the time is right, the conversation is strong, and the science is coming.
What would you say that you learned from being a first mover in cannabis that you were able to then apply to being a first mover in the psychedelic space and then enhance that to becoming a best mover again in this different space?
The world's very unevenly governed. So there's certain jurisdictions where you can do things which will be valuable. And so, for example, if you really wanted to test, I don't know, the dosage capability of THC for a dog so that you could figure out how much could a veterinarian environment apply of THC, you might say, well, where should you do that? I bet the right answer is Chile. And if you wanted to get bioavailability data using proper methods, the right answer for doing that in the most rapid way for THC, probably Czech Republic. When you start thinking based on what is the goal I want, where can I achieve it? The interesting thing is that I found that dogs living in Chile are very similar to dogs living everywhere else in the world. Like there's not like this dog that's specific to Chile that you're checking on. It's totally different than all of the dogs, because that would be like a cat or a horse. So it's the same thing with humans. If you can use German labs to do a drug-on-drug complete panel test, and suppose you could get a process by which you were able to get approval in, say, Germany for approach to causing a male patient age 55 to 70 to have this kind of sleep over this duration. So they don't sleep well now. How do I cause them to sleep well? How do I put them through a lab? You might be able to do that in Germany where you could and have federal support, but couldn't do it in America. The interesting part is that problem is the male demographic of that age group, and it's not whether or not they have a German or American accent. And so what you have to be is nimble in thinking about how do I get the data I need to protect the position I want that's a global opportunity. And so I would say in both psychedelics, and I like to think of these, in some ways they're psychedelic inspired, that's what we capture with MindMed. In others, it's regulated recreation, like, you know, the Netherlands is a good place for that, for Red Light Holland, but so is Brazil. So is Jamaica. So is probably any place that started with a Dutch origin. So I tend to think it's really important that whoever's leading the place spends their time, at least a third of it, thinking about the rule book, and not more than two thirds of it thinking about what is it they want to do, because the rule book matters. Where can I do what I want?
And you spoke a bit about examples for cannabis there. Can you shed some light on what the rule book looks like globally for psychedelics? I guess we might want to talk about some of the research MindMed is doing. Presumably that has collaborations in foreign territories that are more open to the sort of things you want to find out. Is there anything you can reveal on that front?
Well, there's a little bit, but also, like, so the FDA is sort of the, it's in America, so everybody references the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, as the regulator of gold standard. I'm not sure it's true, but if people say it enough times, it probably is. So why, what spooks them about psychedelics? It's a hallucinogenic effect, right? So one of the things that you want to think about is something effective on how you perceive your world environment, yourself in it? Is it effective because it's hallucinogenic, or is it effective because there are other attributes in that plant-based concoction? And if you took away the psychedelic effect, could you still cause opioid weaning? Oh, well, that's a good question, especially if what it meant would be that the result could then be approved and regulated under the FDA because you got rid of their problem. And so I give that as an example because I think if you think about the existence of psychedelics and what they are is pretty well known. The possibility of creating new ones, I think, is robust because some of these have been invented. And then the methodology by which you evolve them so that you fit regulatory frameworks could be the big winner. And so I'm part of the reason I liked MindMed was they were very interested, particularly a couple of the leaders, very interested in how do we achieve our goal while evolving what we're using to meet the rules. Because that's sometimes an easier pathway. You'd say, well, God, evolving a psychedelic, that could take like 5, 6, 7, 8 years to get it through a process. Okay, yeah. Now, if they've already done 4 or 5 of that, that could be a good thing. Because tell me, how long does it take to change the regulations in America when, you know, the vote right now is if somebody gets a cold, you don't know if it's going to become a Republican win or a Democrat win in some of the votes because it's 50-50. Changing mega rules might take forever compared to changing molecules.
And in that, do you have interest as well as overseeing change in molecules and helping to, I guess, influence and change micro rules? You know, we speak about the FDA sort of leading the way and, you know, being the first mover for a lot of things around regulations. But is there an argument to say, or is there an interest from your side in perhaps engaging in policy conversations with smaller countries that perhaps on their own don't have as much influence as their US, but maybe enough of these smaller countries changing their policy frameworks would have enough of a significant effect?
Yeah, I think one of my friends called me when we got the $4 billion US in from Constellation, and he's a TV personality. And he's kind of a hilarious TV personality. And he called me, he said, Bruce, I'm going to be retiring almost instantly. I said, oh shit, why is that, James? He goes, well, as far as I can tell, now that you got this money, somewhere there's going to be a beach that I can go that's going to have Corona and cannabis. So why would anybody want to work when you can do that? Now, if you think about that, Canada has done a terrific job of evolving the illicit market supply into legal market supply. And I think COVID's hastened that. But it's only done it for cannabis. And we have a very substantial magic mushroom, psilocybin, illicit market in Canada, and you don't know what you're getting. So I think there's going to be micro discussions that are triggered by how do I get people to come to my Caribbean island beach as soon as they can after COVID versus anywhere else? Because if you think that there was competition for tourism before, you've seen nothing. To restart your economy in some of these places, I think you're going to have terrific conversations about, well, we already produce shrooms. People sometimes get them. Why don't we regulate them and have certain beaches, certain areas where you might be able to buy, a red stripe, a legal and well-produced, tested cannabis product and shrooms. Dosed, structured, packaged, exactly what you want. Because what you don't want is 2 days of your vacation that become disgusting. I think there's going to be those micro policy discussions like, why would New York State implement legal cannabis when they said they weren't ready for a while ago? States all around them are doing it. So now the citizens can go to New Jersey, they can run out the mass, and they can get cannabis legally. That means when you go there, you might not just buy cannabis, maybe you're buying groceries, filling the car up with gas. So you're starting to have economic leakage. And in the post-COVID world, no one can afford running a government economic leakage. They need every penny they can get. Politics matter. And so I think in the case of the post-COVID world, you're going to see public policy discussions that were unthinkable even a year ago. And it will relate to, are we maximizing our opportunity? Are we using our existing rules? Because, you know, Netherlands has run quite well by having smart shops, and they run better now that they have properly produced, dosed, and presented truffles. I bet if I was running Jamaica or involved in Jamaica, I would want to make that part of the draw. And it's already halfway on the books. So I bet we have some interesting conversations about a year from now, but can you believe all these places change that quickly? And I think recreational cannabis, if you don't regulate it as a government, you know what you're actually doing? You're ignoring it. Because it's not like you're inviting it into your country, it already exists. So you're ignoring it. And public policy that's based on ignoring something strikes me as like the least good option. Why don't we just ignore all the speeders? Oh, got a car pile up over there, but we've been ignoring them. We just quit bothering with that. Ignoring a material part of economic transactions in your economy is bad news for your taxes. So I think there's going to be a whole bunch of awakening to quit ignoring, start monetizing. And the only reason governments regulate something is so they can basically monetize it and educate using part of the income and say they did a better job, but they spend 2% on education, 98% goes to the general coffers when they start monetizing anything from shrooms to cannabis. So I think legal cannabis is going to be the biggest boom over the next 3 years in a whole bunch of countries that probably would never have done it.
And you're also putting shrooms on the side with that, or would you not?
I think some places are already 3/4 of the way down the path, right? Jamaica, you could, if you could go to Jamaica, which is hard right now, but if you could go to Jamaica, you can go to retreats that use psilocybin and shrooms. They're published, they're on the web, they're well known, they've got addresses. You can go there and go and have your psilocybin retreat. So it exists, it's there, and it's mostly ignored. It's not legal and it's not illegal. You just have to tip it a little further, and all of a sudden it's on. You know, Mexico says they're on for cannabis now, medical and recreational. Canada's got that. Canada didn't go weird and crazy. So I think there's an open conversation about what else comes from a plant, exists broadly, and is being ignored.
On the podcast, we've talked about shrooms and ketamine, indeed, for psychedelics. Mm. One thing that we haven't talked about yet with the few guests we've had before you is LSD. And now I know that that's something that MindMed is looking into very seriously. So to take the conversation away from psilocybin for a bit, can you talk a little bit about perhaps the therapeutic effects of LSD as opposed to the many companies that are trying psilocybin-based things, and also what the regulatory future looks like for LSD?
Yeah, and you know, it's good to take it in this direction, because I find I'm interested in psilocybin principally in the context of Red Light Holland. It's a product people buy and enjoy and use, and it can be microdosed. But I don't think psilocybin is an actual business framework for a big company. It makes a ton of sense. It's got to be a brand and things like a Red Light. I think all of the other options create a platform opportunity, and then the question is, can you evolve them? So with LSD, we made an actual acquisition in Switzerland in MindMed that gave us a great deal of intellectual property and some, I would say, expertise that's unmatched. We haven't announced our roadmap of what we're doing there, but I can tell you that some of the intellectual property potential, some of the target indications are way outside of the strike zone for what everybody else is speaking about. And they're big indications that make sense to aim at, but if you didn't, you know, psilocybin has its beginning and its end. I think you picked up correctly. LSD or variants of LSD have a whole different zone that we can aim at. And, you know, you can jump from there and say, well, then, you know, what about Ibogaine and how can you evolve that? Well, it's another thing we're working on. You know, this platform to me is going to sometimes be collaboration. Why do things have to be kept so separate? Collaborations between various molecules and drugs that enable an outcome you want might become the way things start going. And so part of the discussion JR and I had at the very beginning, as I said, you know, if I were a scientist and I was pretty sure I was right and I was working with some of these psychedelics in a corner of the world where I was allowed to, in the back of my mind, I would still have, can I generate enough interest and capital to pursue what I'm doing? And what if I'm wrong? Can I afford to lose? And that downside risk, the mitigation of it, one way is to join on a platform company, get on an ARC is what we began calling it, and let us share some of the risk with you, because we have maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 different pursuits. And we would think that with that combination of pursuits and expertise that some number of them will win and some might not. But if you're a winner and joined the ARC, you've shared your winnings. But if you're a loser and you joined the ARC, you have an upside still. And that we then can share common services, everything from finance to capital raising to positioning. And so I'm fairly optimistic about all of the things beyond psilocybin and the idea of onloading them into an environment where they get to collaborate and see what would be the best combo, best single, best evolution to achieve the goal is a very smart and healthy discussion when you start thinking about your, you know, your chief scientist and your chief medical officer and the chair of your advisory board for medical. They now aren't bounded in the same way as we use psilocybin to do everything. Well, psilocybin doesn't do everything. So what we're saying is we don't do everything. We only do certain things. That's not a great way to look at the current opportunity. So I like the way we're playing it.
Am I reading that right? Is that sort of an invitation for other firms or businesses in this landscape to collaborate or join your arc? And if we're on the topic of other firms, something you said in the pre-interview, which I thought was interesting and our listeners should hear, is not only do you hope that they buy stock in your firms, but also that they buy 10 others. Can you talk a little bit about making smart picks in this space for an investor?
Yeah, so to hopefully add a little bit of credibility to my position on the first answer, Canopy, when we built it, part of the reason it got built to what it was is we did 16 rounds of financing, all of which were up rounds. And they were up rounds because we used our liquid stock as a tool to acquire things that ranged from Storz & Bickel as a platform for heat not burn delivery to This Works as a platform for cosmetic delivery to other cannabis producers. We did 31 acquisitions in 6 years because our currency was stronger than that of anything we were buying. So every transaction could effectively be accretive. I think a player like MindMed is in that position where it has a couple hundred million in cash, has a billion plus market cap, and has a target-rich environment of preclinical work done by many that need to find a home to go to the final and next steps. And so using your equity for thoughtful acquisitions is one way to accelerate the outcomes which create value. So yes, it is an invitation on that. On the second part is I do think it's good people. The way I look at investing, and I'm not a day trader or anything like that. My first thought is, how do I feel about the stock market today, this week, this month? Like, do I think bond yields are going to go through the roof and interest rates have to go up because the rate of growth is so high? Oh gosh, stock markets are going to get pounded down. Okay, well, maybe I don't like stock markets. Or if I still do, who do I think will get pounded down? Oh, well, those tech guys went way up too fast. Maybe I'll stay away from them. So there's sectors, right? So first is, do I like markets? Second, do I like certain sectors? Now, I do like the psychedelic sector because it hasn't had the full growth yet. It has expressed potential. So if you like the stock market and you like psychedelics, then you can start picking companies. But at this stage, my view is that if you've concluded you like the market and you like the sector, you probably like 10 names, 5 names. And the way you might decide if you like them is maybe like a Red Light Holland has a revenue now model. Science to follow. A MindMed has a platform I described in an ARC portfolio, and a Compass has a very focused purpose. So you might say, well, I want to get, 2 to 10 of these. But I think that is good for the sector and good for the companies, and that the competition really isn't for any of the companies who are currently categorized as psychedelics. It's not each other at all. It's historic pharma, it's public perception, social bias. But it's not each other. The competition between the companies really won't exist in any material way for a long time. It's really, perception, policy, and big pharma. And so I don't see it as I've got one team. I bought a jersey that says Mike stock picks name. Well, if you do, that's nice. Red Light Holland has some pretty cool merch. MindMed's not bad, but you might want to get a few jerseys.
So would you say that the industry is in such a nascent phase still that it's more of the case of, high tides raise all boats?
Well, to an extent. And then scoundrels all build boats with holes in the bottom. So if the company appears to have been very busy mining about 2 quarters ago and now are the world experts in science, I would dig a little deeper. And there certainly is that. I would say the rate at which pretenders have established themselves in the sector has been much faster than it was in cannabis.
How do you sniff out a pretender? And for perhaps investors that are less educated in this space and au fait with the knowledge that you have, how would you suggest they sniff out pretenders?
Well, you guys did a little bit of that, right? Like, if it's the 37th entrant into a psilocybin storybook, I'm a little bit worried about that. And if they say that they're going to become a dominant and serious company only selling and producing and operating in Canada with psilocybin, like there are very few patients and the regulations haven't evolved enough. So I look like, how textured is the story? How competent does it appear that the entire balance of the management team? And, you know, things evolve. Like, I, to be totally transparent, when MyMed started, we had, you know, a chief scientist kind of person, and we had a small team, and we've accelerated and grown. And now when I look at the texture, competency, and depth of the team, I'm amazed who's been attracted and how rapidly they've been here. So I wouldn't judge everybody super negatively at the beginning if they don't have much. But the final thing that trips me off is when they, I like press releases that announce an achievement or an outcome that should be informative to the shareholder and represents a material thing. If I go into their news area and I see a press release saying that, you know, on Wednesday, we had a very important internal meeting. We discussed what kind of donuts and coffee we'd had, and we think that the team is super motivated for the afternoon. The stock should go up. Those kind of press releases immediately make me never buy the stock. And so if they're press release machines that have no content, I'm totally out of there, because I hate press releases that pre-announce something that doesn't get done. And, you know, companies evolve. Todd at Red Light Holland originally was pressured a lot to have keep having releases. Now I think you'll look at that stock and say, you know, his most recent release was that they have shipped, sold, shipped, and delivered their product to a patient in Brazil. So it occurred. And this means that if you're putting pins on a map to say, where has Red Light now started to have things happen, it's starting to get interesting. That press release 2 years ago, or a year ago when he started, might have said, we've heard of a country called Brazil and they could have patients. Like, that kind of press release is not, that is not the company I want to be around. Now they have to evolve.
I want to talk a little bit more about Red Light Holland, if we may, now that we've touched on it, just because I think you're probably one of the few people we're going to have on this show, at least for season one, who is brave enough to talk about recreational or adult use psychedelics in a serious way, rather than from a cultural point of view. So, of course, what we were just talking about, the import to Brazil was for a medical need for a patient. Yep. But Red Light Holland also does truffles, which are legal under Holland law, truffles being different to mushrooms because they grow underground, and therefore the psilocybin they produce is legal. I don't understand the differentiation. But I just want to know, what's your vision for an adult use recreational psilocybin or psychedelic world? And I ask that with the context that for a cannabis company founder, you're not a huge cannabis consumer, I would say, and I doubt you're very big into truffles either. So I wonder, from that perspective, from a purely perhaps clinical business perspective, where do you see it going and where would you like it to go if they differ?
Right. So if the rules allow you to do it, why do you not do it? I'm not here to apply that people should or shouldn't do something. If it's legal, and what you do then is provide it in a way that is superior. Superior in the context of this means that you are getting what you paid for, that it's accurately produced, accurately packaged, that the quantity is as advertised, and if you came back tomorrow or in 2 years, you will get the exact same result. To me, the responsible approach is to provide what is permitted in the best possible way, superior to all the participants. And that should generate a short-term revenue, but it should also generate massive brand opportunities. Because if you talk about cannabis, what's everybody say? Oh, brands, brands, brands. We need brands. Well, that's true, but you also need differentiation. And so I think Red Light Holland has a phenomenal early opportunity to develop a brand that I don't know where it ends, but it is definitely a launch position very different than cannabis. It's very international. It's a little bit more taboo. And so I think it has the potential for torque. It also has immediate revenue streams, which then should increase your valuation, which allow you to have equity to make acquisitions that accelerate you into other fields. So to me, from a business perspective, you're actually taking advantage of the regulations to create something that could be bigger than the original market. And I think that's an astute move. Other jurisdictions, you have to, if you bet they're never going to open up or create more opportunity, then you got to wonder where else you move, and there's some choices. But I'm comfortable with that. And I like the world that gives me revenue today in some ways. And I like the world that has a big dream. In the traditional psychedelics, most people are talking about sometime in the future for revenues, if ever. And Red Light's talking about now and talking about how it leverages that. So I like that. I also have to like leadership. Todd, who is the principal founder, is someone who's never been a CEO before, but he's one of the better capital allocators and most rapid learners I've ever worked with in terms of how to structure a transaction to raise capital, how to be very, very careful with allocating it, and to make what I think are very good deals. So I like working with people that, like, I don't know how to do most of the things we're going to do, but if we talk about it and work through it, we may end up with a great outcome. And so he's that way. It's not a huge market yet, but do you want to wait till the market gets huge before you start your company to be the number one company in that space? I don't know. I think it could be a very interesting company in terms of what does it become over the next 1, 2, and 3 years.
And in terms of the red light approach that you mentioned earlier, sort of profits first, science later, is that something that you see as a really good working formula, but exclusive to Red Light Holland, or is that a, I guess, business format that you feel could be replicated by a number of other organizations in the psychedelic space?
Yeah, I'm not sure it hit profits, but at least revenue, and revenue shows that people care. And so I think that there are others additional to Red Light that are doing it, not necessarily in the same framework, but if you were like looking at Field Trip and said, do they generate revenue by having clinics? And are people going to those clinics, virtual or real? And are they, you know, going through a process of using formerly prohibited ingredients in order to open them up to therapeutic experiences so they can evolve their position? Yes. So there are revenue-generating machines that will show people are adopting the offering, and that the question simply is how are they using that as leverage to create higher market value and then use the higher market value equities to acquire more options as they go forward for more revenues and more business? So it's a first step. It's not a long jump, but there are a couple of ways to do that, and those would be two that I point to.
I think we've probably got time for one last question here, and so I'll give you something that I think might be a short personal one to sum up, but I can't help but notice, as I mentioned before we went on air, that as you've transformed in the COVID lockdown, you look far more like what someone might assume a psychedelic investor would look like, and by that I mean a long hair, a bit of a goatee. Are you turning away from the boardroom aesthetic and style? How is this new Bruce Linton going to come out of the cocoon of COVID lockdowns?
It's hilarious because part of, like, I absolutely look like the version you described, who's also not particularly, you know, like almost unwashed, right? Like, it's stylings by the Unabomber. And my answer has been that social distancing is much easier when you look like someone that people are afraid of. And so when I'm at the grocery shop going up and down the aisles, I look like that. And the other point I make is that there's a photo on my passport that I don't look at all like. And as soon as I'm permitted, and I can hardly wait to go somewhere again, I will at minimum get some of my hair cut, probably shave off this crazy beard and mustache, and try to resemble in some way the person on the passport. But until then, I just feel like COVID, a lot of the disciplines we had to exercise to look the way we looked before were because when you would go to meet someone, so if you're running the first to become the biggest cannabis company and you show up high, or you show up like you smell like you might be high, or you show up wearing a t-shirt with a big marijuana leaf, all of those may mean something to you, but they diminish your chance of success with capital markets. So I always tried to think about how do I create at least the first 10 to 30 seconds of an interaction with media or a serious investor where they're off guard, I'm not. And they had stereotypical perceptions and expectations, none of which I helped realize for them, which usually put them off their foot. And in one case, I went on a business program where I knew this person was not pro, was very, very quick to be lippy and make comments. So on that occasion, I went out of my way to have a 3-piece blue striped suit with white button-down collar, shirt, no tie. Hair had been cut prior day, looked absolutely the opposite of what was expected. And the two interviewers, the one that I was concerned about, sat silently for almost 3/4 of the interview trying to figure out what was going to be his access point to making some smart-ass comment. And the effect was we had a terrific interview on a very serious business topic. And so right now I look like I really am quite disheveled, but it's because Zoom and all this stuff permits it. But I don't think it's an advantage to fulfill stereotypes in the mind's eye of media or investors when you want to take them on a journey to understand something that's important. And so getting a haircut and a shave, I think, will be worth achieving the goals I want to achieve when I actually go out and interact with people.
Thank you very much. And it helps to me to know that you're when it's not for the outside performative aspect, the natural Bruce is more akin to the wild spirit that led the psychedelic and cannabis revolution of early days. And I think that's probably all we've got time for. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us once again. You've been incredible. No
problem. Thanks, guys. Have a great one. Talk to you later.
Please take me above. Take me with you.